Welcome to That Medic Podcast, your bi-weekly dose
of all things digital health, global health, and leadership.
My name is Success, a student at Cambridge University.
And I am Simmer, a student at Harvard University.
Join us as we chat with some top professionals in healthcare. Enjoy. Today, we are joined by Dr. Hayes van den Brink, the Global Head of Immunology, Infectious Disease and Ophthalmology Discovery and Early Development at Roche Pharmaceuticals. Hayes has an extensive medical background and trained as an internal medicine physician at the University of Amsterdam before specializing in gastroenterology and hepatology, specifically in the understanding and management of inflammatory bowel disease. Hayes pursued his passion for research, becoming a professor of experimental gastroenterology at the Tidgat Institute for Liver and Intestinal Research, with a focus on the mucosal epithelial homeostasis and the mode of action of drugs in inflammatory bowel disease. Hayes then took his talents to the pharmaceutical industry, where he now oversees all discovery and translational clinical research for immunology, infectious disease, and ophthalmology for Roche. Today's podcast is perfect for anybody thinking of a career in pharma and wants to know the best way to get involved as a student. So without further ado, let's have a listen. So geez, as a kind of tradition on the podcast, we do ask our guests why medicine, you know, why medicine-related business. And if I'm not mistaken, you actually trained as a medical doctor, right, before pursuing a career in pharmacy. So I guess my question for you is twofold. First, why did you choose to study medicine in the first place? And then why did you choose to leave in pursuit of the career in pharmacy that you've done?
Yeah, thanks, Success. It's really great to be here talking to you about the journey I sort of took in medical science, I would say. And science is the theme, and applied science, I would say. I really loved the beta sciences in school, so math, chemistry, physics.
Yeah.
But I also realized by the end of when I finished school that I wanted to apply science if I went in there. So I went actually and went to an open day to look at civic engineering. Didn't really have the human aspect in it. I guess maybe my dad is a mathematician and my mom is a psychologist. So I ended up somewhere in the middle.
Strong scientific background then, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to have that human interaction. So I decided that medicine might be very interesting then. And also realizing that if you study medicine, you learn something that you can apply anywhere in the world.
Facts.
And that's really... Yeah, it was very useful in the rest of my career, I have to say.
I can imagine, yeah. Okay,
yeah, cool. I worked in many places.
Yes, you have. Just some of the things that I've kind of noted down, you worked on the United European Gastroenterology Committee, you're a member of the European Crohn's and Colitis Organization Committee, you worked at GlaxoSmithKline, Pharma, now Roche, the Academic Medical Center. It seems like you've kind of done it all in your career, which is amazing, yeah.
Yeah, I guess the first thing that happened was when I was studying medicine, I was a little bit disappointed actually as to the scientific aspects of the study itself. I mean, lots of medicine is very descriptive, right? Mm. You collect as much information on a patient as you can, much of it very imperfect, and then you create a differential diagnosis, you do some additional tests, and then you go for a diagnosis and see if the intervention that you come up with actually has an effect. And often when the intervention doesn't have an effect, you might not be sure even if the diagnosis or so. But by coincidence, I guess I had an opportunity to spend a year in Boston. That was the first time I went abroad. And okay. I ended up in a basic science lab. And it was a bit of a coincidence, but I discovered my love for basic science.
Yeah.
And then I went back to Amsterdam, finished my rotations, and decided to go for a PhD in the lab, basically, and spent many years in the lab.
And what was that PhD on?
Well, the intent was to discover the LPS, so endotoxin co-receptor, that wasn't known at the time. This I'm talking now late 90s. Yeah. And I guess the first week I started my PhD, there were two back-to-back papers in Nature, if I remember correctly, that described exactly what I was going to look for.
So, literally the worst possible timing.
Well, or the best,
or
right?
The best, yeah, true.
Yeah. because it would have been worse if I would have been at the end of my PhD.
Oh, so God, yeah.
I didn't have a plan, and that was really great because I had many ideas and I could try a lot of different things in the lab. And then I ended up studying how the pathways that make you as an embryo, basically, that lay down the patterns of the tissues of our organs, how they influence pattern maintenance in adult tissues. So why is the gut constantly turning over but always looking the same, right? What are the pathways that regulate? That it became my research topic and something that I worked on with a lot of enthusiasm for many years.
Yeah, that is really, really interesting. Yeah, I mean, I think what I've kind of found as a bit of a disappointment is a strong word, but something I wish I could do more of is that, you know, because medicine is just so, so vast and the human body is so, so complex, as doctors, you just simply don't have the time and energy and capacity to try and figure out the biochemical and pathophysiological processes behind everything, right? And that's the most interesting bit, in my opinion, right? That's the really, really cool stuff, the real hardcore science. And so, yeah, I guess the stuff that you've done is really, really cool. And I guess moving forward to your then career in pharmacy, would you say that it's your desire to kind of understand the proper science that led you out of direct clinical medicine and into a career in pharmaceuticals?
Well, what was really in between, and this is, I think, important if you consider a career in pharmaceutical sciences, is that I built an academic research group in academia, right? So I had many years first in academia, and I became a professor at the university, and then I wrote grants, and I got many grants and published papers, and then you write more grants. but that was a little bit the cycle. I really loved doing that, creating a hypothesis, getting the money to test your hypothesis, then guiding the PhD students and the postdocs to work on big questions. And then writing your results in a paper is one of the most rewarding things. But on the other hand, if you've done that, I did that for about 10 years, right, or a little bit more. But there is nothing at the end of it other than the paper. So, and that... And then on the other hand, I was a gastroenterologist and I saw a lot of patients with Crohn's and colitis. And we were a referral center in Amsterdam for much of the Netherlands. So I had a lot of complicated patients with complicated disease. And only part of those I could really help. But I had a lot of ideas of what could be done for this disease and the science that could underlie some of the questions I was trying to address. So that became at the end a big motivator to move to pharmaceutical industry. One, this wish to do more for the patients that I couldn't treat. And two, I guess, turning science into something useful, that what originally also motivated my choice for medicine. And that's what I do today. I make products that ultimately have an impact on people's lives. And that is incredibly rewarding if it works.
But I actually want to briefly touch on something that you just said. That's really, really interesting. And something I've come to the same conclusion as well. And it's that working in somewhere like pharmaceuticals really gives you the opportunity to have an impact on so many lives, right? Your research has been on, you know, gastroenterology and particularly inflammatory bowel disease. And I think the stat is like 10 million people worldwide suffering from inflammatory bowel disease, right? And symptoms range from, you know, embarrassing on a night out to potentially life-threatening. And so I guess the work that you're doing, you know, if you can create something that helps these people, you know, that's 10 million lives that you've immediately just made so, so much better, right? And not to discredit the work of an individual doctor, but there is a limited reach, right, that you can have as a clinician working purely in the clinic, right? You know, the most amazing doctor will save over a very, very illustrious career, like, you know, 100, 200, 1,000 lives, right? Because the majority of it is just managing long-term conditions. But the work that you're doing is like, that has real long-term, widespread, far-reaching impacts. And I think that is really, really, really attractive for people who want, whose primary motivation is, you know, to help people. Yeah, I think that's really, really cool. So Could you talk to me a little bit more about the specific research that you're doing on inflammatory bowel disease with Roche? Like, what is it you guys are actually looking at? What's the aim? What's the process? How far have you guys got? That kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, maybe I'd like to say that working with individual patients, right, in the outpatient clinic setting or the ward is of course, incredibly rewarding.
And of course,
you get to know them really well, and you can make a big impact on one person's life. And that really inspires what I do today. So it is almost like they're sitting around me sometimes, you know, when I think about how to tackle this disease and many others, because now my portfolio of diseases is much broader, but still thinking about IBD, where I had most clinical experience myself.
Yeah.
What I noticed there, for example, right, is that there is this really interesting discrepancy between the mucosal inflammation, so the inflammation in the bowel, right, in the colon and small intestine that these patients have, and their symptoms. So you can have patients that have remarkably large ulcers when you scope them, and yet hardly feel any pain. And then on the other hand, there are patients that have already healed basically their bowel wall after you've treated them with a drug, and yet still have a lot of remaining pain and diarrhea. So the biology that underlies the pain and the diarrhea seems to be different from the biology that underlies the mucosal inflammation and the ulceration.
Yeah.
And that is really something fascinating. And there's actually quite a lot of science that underlies that and how your nerve endings in the gut interact with your immune system. So the goal of part of our strategy is to combine drugs that reduce this mucosal inflammation with drugs that improve the sensitization in your gut, basically, and motility. And that has really been inspired by my patients, because very often those kind of symptoms are ignored by physicians. And this is a really interesting phenomenon, I think, that I saw in myself and colleagues, is that you try to focus when you see a patient on the things that you can treat, right? So so this abdominal pain and diarrhea, because it was something that was, there was no therapeutic intervention for it that actually worked, it also didn't get a lot of attention in the outpatient clinic, and it almost starts to disappear for many physicians as a problem. Whereas if you ask the patients, it's top priority.
It's their biggest issue, yeah.
Their disease, right? So this is really fascinating. If we do market research and we ask physicians what we really should try to create, and we go out and ask patients, the answers are often completely different.
Interesting.
So I try to stay close to what the patient needs and not what the colleague needs.
Yeah, true. Yeah, I think it's, you know, this is just my first year actually being on wards and seeing patients, but it is really, really easy to kind of just get bogged down in the minutia of the specific disease, right? What you think is the path, is the physiology behind it and the pathology, and you know what you think should be the symptoms. And so it's very, very easy to, and if you're not careful, to kind of forget that you're not treating the disease, right? You're treating the patient, right? And it's what the patient experiences that is the problem that they're meant to be focusing on. So yeah, I think it's very, very insightful. And I guess a lesson for all us young medical students kind of moving forward, that the patient should always be the focus. And I think, yeah, inflammatory bowel disease specifically is a really, really interesting one, because you know, from my very limited understanding, you've got also obviously ulcerative colitis and you've got Crohn's, and they have different, you know, disease patterns. But from what I've kind of seen, it seems like every single person's their specific kind of disease progression is different. You know, loads of different things come into play, right, to determine how somebody suffers from this condition. So it would be like their genetics and biopsies that you look at, and their nutrition, and all these kind of things kind of mean that there are more than just these two categories of inflammatory bowel disease. It's more than just ulcerative colitis and Crohn's, right? In my opinion, there might be, you know, subcategories even beyond that. And so there's, I guess, potential there to try to stratify patients into even more specific categories and then optimize treatment based on those subcategories. And yeah, I think that's something that could be worth. I mean, I'm not here to offer my professional opinion on anything. It could be something so that is interesting.
Stratification is absolutely very important. What I've also learned from my own experience, even when I was in academia, is that when we talk about phenotypes and stratification, we often talk about the extremes. Mm. And then maybe 10% are, for example, in IBD, you treat patients with anti-TNF antibodies, right? Infliximab, adalimumab.
Yep.
And we talk about responders and non-responders. But when we looked in our own database, we tried to build a database of responders and non-responders. There was maybe 10% of complete responders and 10% of complete non-responders. And 80% of the patients were somewhere in this overlap of response and non-response, depending on the endpoint you use. Mm. Whether you look at inflammatory bowel and biomarkers, whether you look at the biopsy, the endoscopy, the clinical symptoms, it's really difficult often to define these phenotypes. So ultimately, what I've come to believe is rather than, I mean, you want to understand the phenotypes or endotypes, as we often call them, and their biology. And then probably what you need to do is make some form of combination therapies, because many patients will have overlaps of these endotypes or phenotypes. So that is really where I think we will be going, these combination therapies.
And specifically, what kind of drugs would you be combining, I guess? What would these combination therapies consist of?
Well, it's really interesting because the proof of concept has already been delivered by Janssen Pharmaceuticals, colleagues in the US. They have an antibody against TNF, and they combined it with their antibody against interleukin-23, another inflammatory molecule that is very important in inflammatory bowel disease. And they clearly showed that they could almost double. So it was additive. It was not synergistic, but it was additive. Most endpoints. So, and that is really very significant, because at the moment, the best we can achieve in patients with inflammatory bowel disease, in all comers, as we call it, so without baseline stratification,
right,
so any patient gets treated the same, is about 20% difference from placebo. So in terms of clinical remission, so not really great, right? If you correct for the placebo effect, we can only help 1/5 of patients, or at least get them into complete clinical remission.
Mm.
And with this combination therapy, you can raise that to 30-40%, which is very significant. You almost double it. Yeah, so I think that is really a future. And the trick will be, obviously, to figure out which pathways to combine, modes of action, and keep it safe. Because sometimes if you block one pathway, it's safe. But if you block two, maybe you get a risk for certain infectious diseases. And that's one thing that we always have to balance very carefully.
Yeah, it does seem like quite a delicate balancing act. Whenever you mess with the body's kind of endogenous protein and chemical supply. But that is really, really, really interesting. This kind of deep, hardcore science is, I guess, definitely the reason why I wanted to go into medicine. And I imagine the same as for other people. So for those of you out there, a career in pharmacy, absolutely, absolutely feasible. But kind of going on to you specifically, so you're now the global head of immunology, infectious disease, and ophthalmology discovery and early development. Congratulations, by the way, very, very well done. what does I guess this position involve, both overall, so on a large scale, and on a day-to-day basis? What do you actually get up to?
Yeah, so the way it works basically is that we have at Roche, we have two large R&D centers, one based in San Francisco, one in Basel, and I'm based in Basel. And in our unit in Basel, we have 2,400 people basically, and they're divided into different groups. So we have three large therapeutic areas. There's oncology, neuroscience, and then I'm responsible for the other therapeutic areas.
Mm-hmm.
And we have all the biologists and the physicians and the clinical scientists and research technicians. And then there are two very large groups that we intersect with, that we form a matrix with. And that makes it very different from academia. And that is one group that makes all the molecules. We call it therapeutic modalities. So they make small molecules, antisense molecules, antibodies. And we now have lots of other things, modalities, as we call them, that we're working on. And one big group that is important for the toxicology, for clinical pharmacology. So understanding, you know, whether we have the right dose, how the molecule behaves in the body, how it's eliminated. So, and then we work in large teams on molecules that we then try to move from discovery to clinical development.
And my
job is to make sure that we have a strategy in place. And then I'm more involved in immunology because that's more my own background. But I have very experienced colleagues that lead the ophthalmology and the infectious diseases groups. And on my day-to-day basis, it means that I have a lot of meetings trying to connect different parts of Roche, because Roche is a company of 100,000 people.
Yeah, it's right? massive. So,
I try to understand what's happening in other parts of the company, especially also in our other R&D unit in San Francisco, and the organization that all our medicines go to, which is a late-stage organization that's a separate organization in Roche that does all the phase 3 studies. So it's a lot of...
A lot of moving parts to manage, I imagine.
And yeah. then we need to make sure that we have an attractive culture to work in, right, in this group of 2,400 people, so that we work on a diverse and inclusive work culture where it's safe to speak up, where you dare to, because one of the most important things in medicine is psychological safety. Actually, that's where it was discovered, the whole concept of psychological safety, right? The ability to challenge authority. And to indicate when things are going wrong, and that is equally important in research and development and pharmaceutical development in particular.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, the importance of diversity and being able to challenge people in a professional manner definitely can't be understated. I think it's such a shame. If you know you were to limit your scope of view to just one group of people, because then there's just so many different points of view and ways of looking at things out there that you're just not able to access. And to Rush's credit, and yeah, you guys' credit, there's been a big push I've seen for diversity lately. And yeah, I'm kind of excited to see where this whole thing goes. But I guess moving on, what would you say are some of the unique advantages that you've noticed from working within pharma? And secondary to that, what have you personally enjoyed about working within the industry? What are the best takeaways for you specifically?
Yeah, so they are at very different levels. One thing I mean, the most amazing thing is the quality of the people. That's something I didn't really realize when I was studying medicine and initially in my research. It's the quality of the science that happens in pharma. And the budgets that are available and the number of people that are at the top of their game in very different areas of science that come together in one team to try to make a molecule that improves people's lives. That is really, I haven't seen that anywhere else. I mean, I've seen that in different pharma companies, but not in academia. And that's extremely rewarding to be working in an environment like that. And it's true teamwork, because I really like the academic system of peer review and authorship and publication. I've thrived in that, but it has one big disadvantage, and that you need to have sufficient publications with senior authorships, either first or last authorship, to get grants to pay for your research and test your hypotheses, right?
Yeah.
Now, in pharma, it's not at all the case. You don't care, because we publish because we find it very important to be transparent on what we do. Right? There's even an obligation to publish any clinical study we execute, and that's really good. But it's not the goal of what we do. So when people work in a team to make a molecule and to pull it through discovery and development, nobody is worrying about ownership, because all we care about is to give this molecule a chance, and not where you end up in a publication. So that it's much easier to have true teamwork in an environment like that, because you don't have this moving factor of ownership, I would say.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's what, and the other is really mundane. when I was in academia, I used to work every weekend, writing papers, writing grants, teaching students, doing night shifts, doing weekend shifts.
Yeah.
And now I have a really 9-to-5 job. That's actually not so bad. Obviously, you know, I sometimes have to do a lot of reading in the weekend. But I would say that I think I spend more time with my three kids now than when I was in academia, because it's much more limited to the week, and I have a lot of support, right? I have an admin, I have a head of operations, we have, communications. And in academia, I was everything myself. I was my own admin, my own HR, my own books, my own
writer. From the CEO to the lowest worker, you're everything, basically,
Yeah, you're doing a one-man job. That's totally different. We're a very professional organization, and we're not asking people to work in the evening or the weekend unless it is necessary. You know, sometimes we're under a lot of time pressure.
And
that quality of life aspect is not insignificant, I always find.
Yeah, I can imagine. I mean, I am very getting a slight insight into what it means to have to work night shifts. So I am I'm currently, as we're recording this, I'm currently in my emergency medicine block on placement. Oh, nice. And we're having to do like twilight shifts. That's like till like 2-3 in the morning in emergency medicine. And it is crazy. It is crazy. But fun. But I absolutely can understand how after, you know, decades working in that kind of situation, it's good to just have a nice 9-to-5 where you can just go home and see your kids and chill out at the weekend. Lord knows you've earned it.
When I did my internal medicine training, I also did intensive care medicine.
Mm.
And I did love to be in the intensive care at night with this small team, you know, doing important work, or when you would come into, when I would be on call as a gastroenterologist and go from home to the hospital to do an endoscopy, and you enter into this eerie, large building with half the lights on. It has a very special atmosphere. So I didn't mind doing it, but there is something to be said to have more time with the family, I have to say.
Absolutely. And I guess we've spoken quite a lot about, you know, the allure and the attraction to kind of going into pharmacy and the pharmaceutical industry. So, you know, speaking to medical students who might be in second, third, fourth, fifth year of med school, how would you, or what advice would you give to somebody looking to get into pharmacy, whether to work at a company like Roche or, God forbid, one of your competitors or something like that? what kind of advice would you give?
Difficult. So there are two ways to enter into there are many ways to enter, I guess. But if you want to enter in a very senior position, right, then you really first have to start an academic career, get a professorship, and be successful in publishing papers and become a key opinion leader, basically. Then you can enter really in a strategic level in the pharmaceutical industry. And but you can also start early in your career and then work, you know, on projects and gradually grow in this industry to a more leadership role, if you like leadership. In general, I would check if you really like research. And I'm not sure how often this happens in the UK, but in the Netherlands, it's very usual to do a PhD when you're a medical student. So we have loads of MD PhDs. And I think that is not only a fun thing to do a PhD, but it also really teaches you to be a better doctor, I would say. And by the time you get back to the clinic, you're more experienced in decision making, independent. Yeah, I've seen that in my opinion and experience, people that have a PhD have learned such valuable lessons that they become better physicians. And if you then turn out to really, if you then really like the research, that could be a signal that you might want to think also about an alternative career in pharmaceutical discovery or development. But it would start probably with some research experience.
Awesome. So like you said, one of the ways that you can kind of get into it is by starting early. And to that end, I believe Roche has kind of announced a new student internship available, if I'm not mistaken. Could you kind of talk to me a little bit about what that involves, what that entails?
Yeah, that's actually a good point. Obviously, the best way to see if it's something for you is to join a pharmaceutical company. And if you're in Cambridge, right, AstraZeneca is right around the corner. Fantastic company. Mm. And so is GSK, by the way, where I was myself. That's in Stevenage, of course. And yeah, if you're talking about Roche, right, we have a great resource, which is if you just Google career at Roche, you come to our careers website. And if you go to the careers website, it has a label on top. It says students and graduates. Click on the students and you find everything you want to know about internships in Roche. And we have one particular internship that I think you may be referring to is with the Black Medic Society at Cambridge. But we have many other internships, so anyone can really have a look at the website. Internships are paid, so you get... in general, it's a minimum of 3 months, and it's actually great to come for a year. You get housing, you get a salary, so it's a really positive experience, and you get true appreciation of what it is like to be in a pharmaceutical company, I think, and get to experience the Basel life.
There are no downsides.
No, I mean, it's really fun. I mean, Basel was a big surprise to me how much,
really?
How beautiful. City is, yeah.
Oh wow, it's amazing. Yeah, I mean, Switzerland is just an amazing place. Full stop. I'm pretty sure. I think it's like the sixth happiest place to live in the world, or something. Yeah. So anyone who's kind of looking into career in pharmacy, definitely apply for these internships. Who could say no to Basel life? I certainly couldn't.
I mean, it's a lot of happy place because the big hubs in pharmaceutical industry in Europe are Denmark, so around Copenhagen.
Yeah.
Basel, Zurich, and I guess the UK, and then there's the US. It's Boston, San Francisco is the main, and New Jersey, which may not be the place of where you want to end.
Give me Switzerland any day. Give me Switzerland any day. Yeah. Anyways, thank you so much for kind of joining me to kind of talk about your career and give me some advice. Yeah. And give all of us some advice kind of on what it takes to go into the pharmaceutical industry. It has been a pleasure speaking to you. Really, really, really fun speaking to you and really, really insightful. And I cannot wait to kind of see what you guys at Roche do next. These combination drugs you're talking about are really, really interesting. And yeah, like inflammatory bowel disease is one of those conditions that like it's not seen in the newspapers all the time, right? It's not like cancer or heart failure or Alzheimer's or dementia, right? But it's something that has such a huge impact on so many people. And so the work that you guys are doing is kind of invaluable in making people's lives better, which at the end of the day is what we're here to do, right? So yeah, thank you so much for that. And thank you so much for joining me on this episode. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for the chance to talk to you, Success.
Pleasure.
It won't be all the right. Last time.
And that is the episode. Thank you guys so, so much for listening. Please remember to subscribe, rate us, and leave a positive review if you enjoyed. Also, head to the description to follow us on all social media so that you never miss an update.